It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Carl Erskine is our guest today. He pitched for the Brooklyn and later Los Angeles Dodgers from 1948 to 1959, was a key player during a great era for Dodgers baseball that was commemorated in the classic book The Boys of Summer by Roger Kahn, who passed away in February of this year. Carl Erskine won 122 games, lost 78 in the big leagues. He pitched two no-hitters and set what was then a record with 14 strikeouts in a World Series game. That was in Game 3 of the 1953 World Series against the New York Yankees. He is the author of What I Learned from Jackie Robinson about his relationship with his teammate, who became the first African-American in Major League Baseball in 1947, and also Tales from the Dodgers Dugout. He lives in Anderson, Indiana, the town in which he was born, and is a prominent citizen there, not just because of his baseball career, but for what he's done for the community. There's a Carl Erskine Rehabilitation Center and an Erskine Elementary School. Mr. Erskine, first of all, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Well, did my mother write that? It sounded so good.
That's
no,
you.
No, we're doing fine in Anderson. I'm a senior now in this time of my life, and retired and enjoying, I won't say the lockdown's enjoyable, but it's been a pleasure to be with my wife without a lot of interruptions.
Well, I want to ask you, of course, about a lot of different highlights from your baseball career, but given that you wrote a book titled What I Learned from Jackie Robinson, and given the situation our country is in at this point, let me ask you first about him. If he were around and active today and could see what's taking place in cities across the country, I would assume it's safe to say that he would be out in front and very visible and very vocal in his support of equal justice for all. Is that right?
I think you hit it right on the nose, because Jackie did not ask anything for himself, particularly. He and Mr. Rickey challenged segregation on the biggest and brightest stage at that time in sports, was Major League Baseball. And Jackie was an intelligent person. He wasn't a ramarazer. He didn't want to cause trouble. He wanted equality. And at one point back when we had kind of a witch hunt for the communists, you're probably too young to know that, but they had Jackie speak at Congress, and he was very specific about what he thought America should do. He said, read the Constitution. It's very plain. Citizens of the United States of America are all equal. That's the only thing I battle for, is equality. So his song would certainly be sung today in what's been happening with race relations. Jackie was wasn't an antagonistic person, but he had a very, very specific reason to be on a platform where his voice could be heard. So you believe me, he'd be out there today.
Well, Jackie Robinson, of course, broke into the majors in April of 1947, and you were pitching. You were just about to break in yourself at Danville, Illinois that year, a part of the year, and having a good year. Were you hearing a lot about what was happening with Jackie, or, of course, you had a lot on your mind in trying to focus on your own baseball career, but was there a lot of news, a lot of talk in the clubhouse about what was happening with Jackie at the big league level?
You know, you're very insightful to say what you just did. Most of us were so we were so focused on our own career. Everything in those years was one-year contracts. Even the managers, no one in my only one time in my career, 12 seasons in the majors, did a manager get more than 1 year on his contract, and that was Leo Durocher about 1952 or three. So we were all focused on how we could stay in the majors. It's tough enough to get there, but it's harder to stay there because you have to produce. You have to be productive to be a player in the majors. And so we knew Jackie was fighting a battle. We understood the race in the 1940s. We were completely divided here in Indiana. It was whites here and blacks there. it was understood. I grew up in a mixed neighborhood and had a good buddy that I played athletics with all through school. His name was Jumpin' Johnny Wilson, a superstar athlete. And so I knew all about what segregation meant. I couldn't sit in the main floor with my buddy, Johnny Wilson, on a Saturday to watch a cowboy movie because blacks were not permitted to sit on the main floor of the theater. So I sat in the balcony with Johnny. So I had good training before I ever met Jackie. And when he asked me why the black-white thing didn't bother me, and I said, one good reason, my best friend in this life is Johnny Wilson, and he's just as black as you are, Jackie. And I said, so you don't ever have to worry about me having any problem with the black and white.
I think you wrote that Johnny Wilson may have eaten as many meals at your house as he did at his house when both of you were growing up.
Absolutely. We didn't have any barrier there. There was no feeling. There was no saying, well, you can't. Now, Johnny understood that when they had a free YMCA swim program on one Saturday during the summer, he knew he couldn't go. And we knew, our buddies in the neighborhood, we all knew Johnny couldn't go swimming. So we never went swimming either. And so it was just the way we handled it as kids. We didn't have a big problem with people all around this mixed neighborhood. So that was a good platform for me to gain the respect, which I did. A lot of good black families lived in my neighborhood, and hard workers. And we were all poor right after the Depression in the 30s. So I did have a good background, and it was almost like it was preparation for me to meet and play with Jackie for 9 seasons. And we became good friends.
You came along to the major leagues, got there just a year after he got started, and you said that he provided some encouragement to you very early in your time with the Dodgers that meant a lot to you.
Well, I'll tell you how I met Jackie. It was interesting. It was Fort Worth, Texas, Double A. I had my second season in pro ball. And the big club, the Dodgers, preseason, came through Fort Worth, their affiliate, to play a preseason game. And I started the game against the big club, didn't know anybody on it. And I pitched 5 innings and no score, gave up a couple of hits. But after the game, a voice, "Where's Erskine?" And my teammate says, Carl. And it was Jackie Robinson who walked across from the Dodger dugout to the Fort Worth dugout and asked for me by name. Well, I stepped out and shook hands with Jackie, and the first time I'd ever met him. And he said, "Young man, I hit against you twice today in this game. You're not going to be here very long with that kind of stuff." Sure enough, by mid-season, I'd won 15 in Fort Worth, and I joined the Dodgers July 25th, 1948. And the first guy to my locker when the bus came with the team was Jackie. And he shook my hand again, and he said, "I told you, you couldn't miss." And so from that point on, the next several years, even after our playing days, Jackie and I had contact with each other. And what an encourager he was for me as a minor league kid to come over and give me that. And all during my career, he'd come to the mound in a tight spot, and he'd say, "Carl, if anybody can get out of this jam, you can do it." So he was a real encourager for me.
The challenge for him and the agreement that he made with Branch Rickey, who signed him, was to keep silent and have to just simply take the abuse that came his way, and there was a lot of it, and he did that for the first couple of years of his career, not responding to really anybody and getting any confrontations on the field. As his teammate, what did you think when you saw him have to go through what he did in those first couple of years with the Dodgers?
Well, when the publishing company asked me to write a book, because no teammate had ever written about Jackie, they wanted to give me a title about Jackie and me or something. I said, "No, I don't like that." I said, "I learned too much from Jackie. I need to be listening to him, not standing equal to him." So they said, "Well, how about Tales from the Dodger Dugout? what I learned from Jackie Robinson. I said, I like that. What did I learn from Jackie? Well, in answer to your question, I never could imagine anybody, including myself, taking the verbal, even the physical abuse that Jackie did in those early years and not respond. I mean, I'm kind of a peace-loving guy, but I don't think I could have handled the pressure that he was put under with the barbs in the dugout, the booze from the fans, the disrespect. Baseball's a hard-nosed game, and you got to know how to take it in the big leagues because you get tested. Well, boy, Jackie was really tested. But the main thing I learned from Jackie was his self-control. Now, we all need it, and it's the one thing it's hard to get sometimes. And I don't know if I could have had enough self-control to endure the smears and the undignified way that a major league player was treated. Only to put it in context that the major leagues, or baseball in general, is a hard-nosed game from the other dugout. But Jackie had promised Mr. Rickey that he would turn the other cheek. And there's a book that, if you haven't had it, you might want to find it. It's called 42 Faith, and it was written by Ed Henry, who is an anchor on Fox News. He took the approach that Mr. Rickey was a strong Christian, raised by a strong Christian mother. And Jackie also was raised by a strong Christian mother. And when he picked Jackie out of several really great prospects in the Negro League, he picked Jackie for several reasons. And that was one of them, that he thought Jackie, on the level of his faith, would understand the parable of turn the other cheek. And that's what Jackie promised he could do. And as far as I know, history, written or otherwise, never saw Jackie fight anybody in a restaurant, in the parking lot, at the ballpark. Self-control was the greatest asset Jackie had to accomplish what he did.
Well, certainly he's remembered for breaking the barrier in baseball, and rightly so to this day, with the commemoration by baseball each year on April 15th. Everybody wears 42, and I know that is a meaningful gesture and certainly one that brings back good memories of your teammate. I wanted to ask you about just pitching in Ebbets Field. It's the park has been gone for 60 years, but still, at least among older fans, one of the most famous ballparks in the history of baseball. What do you recall about pitching in Ebbets Field, and in particular the special relationship to the fans in Brooklyn?
Yeah, at my age, I'm 93. Been a long time since I threw a baseball, but I get a lot of fan mail because of a lot of the reason is because of playing, being a teammate of Jackie's. But when I think about Ebbets Field, it was not a popular ballpark for pitchers. It was 297 down the right field line. Had a high fence, but it was a short, really short, any pop fly to right or right center would be up against that fence. Not much foul territory. Fans were very close. In fact, I could stand on the mound and hear the guy in the 10th or 15th row in the lower part of the ballpark talking to me. And they used my name. They corrupted my good name of Erskine to Oyskin, and so I'd hear these yells from the fans, "Hey, Oyskin, throw it through his head." That was my encouragement. Well, Ebbets Field became my most desired place to pitch because both my no-hitters were in Ebbets Field. The strikeout record against the Yankees was at Ebbets Field, and I was so pleased that I happened to do that against the two biggest rivals, for the New York Giants and the New York Yankees, and to accomplish that in front of the home fans, who really were, I'm telling you, Dodger Blue doesn't speak strong enough about the devotion of those people in Brooklyn. They actually loved us like we were part of the family.
Wanted to ask you about some of your other teammates. Of course, the names of Campanella and Hodges and Reese and Cox and Ferrillo and Snyder, still a big part of baseball history today. And one of the early lessons you said you learned as a major league pitcher was to throw whatever Roy Campanella, the catcher, said to throw. What made him so good at that?
Well, actually, Roy was a little bit older than the rest of us because he'd spent a lot of his baseball years in the Negro League, mm-hmm. and also playing in winter season in Mexico, or Cuba, Venezuela. So he, you know, it was no thing for the Black League to play two or three games every day. So Roy had all this experience, and the manager would basically say to young pitchers, if you shake Campanella off, you better have a very good reason. But Campy, I'd kid him, his locker was close to mine. I guess I've pitched well over 1,000 innings to Roy. But he used to tell the young pitchers, you throw what I call, I'll make you a winner. Well, I brought the box score in one day after I'd lost a game. I said, Roy, look at this box score. It says Erskine, losing pitcher. Shouldn't that say Campanella, losing catcher? You call all the pitches. He said, no. Well, you can shake me off, but let me tell you better have a good reason to shake off Campy.
I wanted to ask you, of course, about Pee Wee Reese, who was a leader on the Dodgers for so many years. And, of course, here in Kentucky, he's a native Kentuckian, and we were all very proud of Pee Wee Reese here as we look back over his career. And, of course, later on, he was a broadcaster for many years. What was your association with Pee Wee? What do you remember his contributions to the team?
Well, Pee Wee, of course, was so respected as captain of the team. He was a real pro. That's the highest ranking I could give Pee Wee as a ball player. Of course, he and I were good friends. I visited Louisville many, many times, played golf with him at Audubon Country Club, went to an annual dinner at the Brown Hotel. I think it was called a bullpen club, but it was a big event every year, and they would always honor the manager of the year, the MVP of the year, and so forth. So I went to those banquets for a number of years with Pee Wee. He lived on Eastern Parkway, I believe it was, so we'd stay with Pee Wee. Pee Wee was the ultimate ball player. He didn't say a lot. He wasn't a pop-off. He also never dressed anybody down in the clubhouse, but he had a way of looking at you if you made a dumb play. Or a rookie who would be too chesty about where his locker was or whatever. Pee Wee just had a tactful way of dressing you down, and he could burn your shorts off without hardly saying anything. But he was an excellent teammate and a clutch ball player. Of course, he's a Hall of Famer. And my roommate was Duke Snyder for 10 seasons. Duke and I were close as brothers, and Ferrillo and I did lots of things in the community in Brooklyn. He took me to all of his Italian events. So we had a close bond, raised our kids together in those years. We were all, most of us were in our very early 20s, so we were just kind of raised together. And the team itself had, I think, about 6 Hall of Famers, counting a couple of the managers, 6 or 7 Hall of Famers on that team. And if you're a pitcher, there's 2 things you need to have a good career. A team that can score runs, which this team scored, I don't know, something like an average of 6 runs a game most years. And you need a team that can play defense, can bail you out of a tough giant jam. This Dodger team could play defense. Nobody talks much about that, but, boy, I'm telling you, when the double play was called for, they made it, both ends of it. And so my record in the majors is a good percentage of wins. I think I was 44 games over 500 or something, but I can't take all the credit for that. You got to have defense and a team that can get you some runs. So I was very blessed to pitch for that team, and I still think about that every day.
It was such a great era, not only for the Dodgers, but for baseball in New York in the 1950s and 1951. Of course, I want to ask you about the famous playoff. But in that National League playoff, you had the New York Giants playing the Brooklyn Dodgers to see who would play the New York Yankees in the World Series. Tell me about the level of interest in New York in those games and what it was like in New York at that time being in baseball.
Well, first of all, baseball at that time had 8 teams in each league, the American League. Had 8 and the National League 8. And so the schedule for us in that era was to play 22 times. Each team played each other 22 times a year, 11 on the road, 11 at home. But in New York, the New York Giants were in the National League. So we played the Giants 22 times, all in New York. And so that rivalry over many years, before I got there even, that rivalry was very, very strong. Your manhood was almost on the line when you played the Giants because it was such an intimate situation. And I never knew a family in New York that wasn't split at least 2 ways, and usually 3 in the family. All 3 teams were represented, and that was just how deep the rivalry went was not just on the field, but was in the families. And so when you played the Giants, it didn't matter what the standings were. You were playing these dirty birds across town that we found out cheated on us, but we found out too late. But yeah, the rivalry in New York and the uniqueness of 3 major league teams, I don't think I can ever imagine being a part of the city administration and allowing 2 teams at the same time to exit New York for the West Coast. I just could never understand how politically they could ever let that happen, but that's what did happen.
Yeah, that had to be a devastating time for baseball fans. It happened after the 1957 season, and both teams went west, the Giants, of course, to San Francisco, and the Dodgers to Los Angeles. 1951, of course, was the year that it was probably still the most famous single home run in baseball history in Game 3 of the playoff between the Dodgers and Giants. And the Dodgers were up 4-2. The Giants had 2 men on with 1 out of the 9th inning of Game 3, the deciding game. And Don Newcomb, the starter, was still in the game at that point. And you and Ralph Branca were in the bullpen. And Charlie Dressen, the manager, is about to make a pitching change. What took place there?
Well, you described it exactly, the game situation. The phone rang in the bullpen, and Clyde Sugarforth was our bullpen coach, and he answered the phone. So we could not hear Dressen, but we could hear him being answered by Sugarforth. And so Dressen surely asked him, "Are they ready?" And Suki said, "They're both ready." His next question must have been, "Who's throwing the best?" And Sugarforth said, "They're both throwing fine. Erskine's bouncing his curve sometimes." So I had this hard overhand curveball that it had to be down, but it had to be in the dirt to be a good pitch. And Campy, as I said, pitched many, many innings to Roy. He used to tell me, "Erskine, you bury it, I'll get it." But so the curveball, mine, straight overhand, went straight down. So the circumstances on that day has never been examined very well. But here's my take. Why did Dressen then, did he call me because that could have been a wild pitch? Well, Campy was not catching in that third game. He'd been injured. And Rube Walker was catching. An outstanding catcher, an outstanding arm, good power. But he was slow as the old Texan says, slower than pond water. On his feet, he was very slow. The distance from home plate, where the catcher was, to the backstop was the biggest distance in the National League. There was a lot of room behind the catcher. A wild pitch, 2 men might score. And so based on that reasoning, I think Dressen said, let me have Branca. He didn't want any wild pitches. And I didn't throw a lot of wild pitches. But with Rube catching, which he didn't catch me that much, that's the reasoning, I think, that Charlie Dressen, the manager, called for Branca. And so the rest is history. Tongue-in-cheek, you've probably read this someplace. Somebody says, Carl, what was your best pitch in your 12 seasons in the majors? And I said, well, I think the best pitch I ever threw was a curveball I bounced in the bullpen.
Yeah.
But, you know, I say that with tongue-in-cheek. Ralph Branca went in. He threw two fastballs. The first one, a call strike, right in Thompson's powerhouse. But he took the pitch. And the next pitch was up and in where it should have always been. And that's the ball he kind of crowded himself and hit it in the lower deck of the polo ground. So that was a famous home run. But we found out later that Giants were actually cheating with a telescope and running a wire to the bullpen with a buzzer and from the bullpen, which you could see easily at the plate in the polo grounds. It was out in right field in the foul territory. We found out they'd been cheating all that second half of the season. And Thompson probably, although he would never admit it, he'd always say, yes, I could have taken it. Well, did you take it? Well, if I wanted to, I could have taken it. He would never admit that he took the pitch. They knew what was coming. But that's all history. It's all a part of the lore of baseball. And, yes, I was lucky that I hadn't – somebody told me, a writer had looked up how many times I'd faced Thompson. So what the chances that I would have had if I had come in to pitch? Actually, he told me that I'd struck Thompson out the last three times I faced him. I only faced him 12 times up to that point in my career. But, you know, it's all fun speculation. And I knew Thompson's, he didn't have a weakness necessarily, but he wouldn't get any fastballs ahead off of me, but he would have gotten several curveballs.
And, of course, he did hit the home run to give the pennant to the Giants. And, as I said, it probably is baseball's most famous single home run. And that's an interesting context to add to it, especially given what's happened in the last couple of years with the use of technology and sign stealing and all of that. So there was something going on in the early 50s and I guess probably before that as well.
Well, I think so. Sign stealing was always a part of the game, but nobody anticipated how high tech has come into the world and all the things that could come from that. But the commissioner at that time, Ford Frick, said if I had known what we knew 50 years later, I would have forfeited the game. Well, maybe he would have. But when Houston got caught, they went back to 71, I think it was, in the World Series. I'm not sure what year. But I said, why wouldn't they go all the way back to 51 and give us that series instead of booting us out of a chance to win the play in the World Series again?
And the next year, you pitched the first of your two no-hitters, June 19th, 1952, against the Cubs. And that game was interrupted by a rain delay. And, of course, we're talking about the 51 playoff game. The pitcher who was in the game at the time that you and Branca were warming up was the starter, Don Newcomb. Of course, starters went a lot farther in those days. And then you came back after a rain delay and completed your no-hitter. Tell me about that game and staying in there all the way beyond the rain delay and coming through with the no-hitter.
Well, New York was in Ebbets Field that day, and it was a heavy, heavy, cloudy day, very low clouds, very black. And when we started the game, it was almost certain that it was going to rain. And so we got five runs, I think, in the first inning off of Warren Hacker of the Cubs. And now the pitcher's job now is to pitch as fast as you can. We got to get five innings in before this big rain is going to come. And so that's what we were trying to do. And in pitching fast to Willie Ramsdale, the pitcher for the Cubs at that time. He had come in relief. I walked him on four straight pitches in the third inning, and now hurrying, trying to throw just strikes. And now comes the rain. So we go inside, and our team, the Dodgers, had learned to play bridge. Clyde King had taught us how to play bridge. So a lot of guys like bridge better than playing poker, which we're not supposed to do anyway. But so we sit down around the trunks, and Billy Cox was my partner against Pee Wee and one of our coaches. And so we played for 40 minutes or so, and I just made four hearts in my bid. And they said, "We're going to start again. Let's go. Come on, everybody, get ready." So I had to jump up, put on a dry uniform, and go back out, warm up again, and I finished the game. And it turned out to be a no hitter with a bridge game in the middle, which was, I think, the first and only time that happened.
Yeah,
that was it.
Was there any thought to taking you out of the game at that time, or were you just assumed that you were going back in?
No, you know, it was a mindset in those days that if you started the game, you're supposed to finish it. And that was the goal, and that was a complete game meant something in those days. The pitching staffs are handled entirely different today, and we all know that, Al. Now they take pitchers out after six, seven good innings, and bring in the finishers. The starters were the closers in my era. If I pitched on a day and then rested a day, the third day I would do my throwing to get ready for my start the next day. And the day that the starting pitcher took his throws, the manager would always say, "Throw late in the game. I might need you for an inning." That was a starting pitcher. So that was a closer in those days in many cases. So that just was the way pitching staffs were handled. And so, no, there was no discussion or even no one talked to me. It was my ball game, and I warmed up briefly to start the next inning and then finished it. So, all no-hitters before, I don't know, the 60s maybe, were complete games. But the Hall of Fame finally had to change the standard for multiple pitchers pitching no-hitters, and this happened several times. So it just is a different era and a different way of handling the pitching staff.
We had a great team and a great year the next year. In 53, the Dodgers were 105-49, and you went 20-6 that year, and then had just an unforgettable performance in the 1953 World Series, Game 3, record-setting at that time, 14 strikeouts, and it was a game the Dodgers really had to have, wasn't it?
Yeah, we lost the first two games. In fact, I'd started the first game in Yankee Stadium. Got a little wild for some reason and came out early. And so we lost that game, although I didn't end up getting a loss myself, but the team lost just as bad. And we lost the next game. So we were down two. And I told my roommate, Duke Snyder, I said, "You know, I already failed that first game, and I got to pitch like there's no tomorrow today." So I went out, I had good stuff, and the Yankees, they had a powerful lineup, and it was a real challenge. But I had good stuff, excellent control that day. Wherever Campy moved his glove, I could hit it, and my curveball was exceptional that day. It was breaking fast, and so I didn't know what strikeouts the count was. I was trying to get inning by inning and win that ball game. It was close. It was 1-1 through the first five innings or so, and then we each scored again one run. So it was 2-2 in the bottom of about the bottom of the eighth inning, I think. It was 2-2. And Campanella comes to bat, and if I've got time, I'll tell a quick story.
Sure.
Edward R. Murrow was a famous name in broadcasting back in those days, and he had just started a new show called Talk to the, I don't know what it, have to think about the name of the show. Anyway, it was interviewing celebrities in their own home. That had never been done on any scale at all. So Campanella was the first guest. So they had a practice night the night before Game 3 and the series. So Edward R. Murrow said, "Now, Campy, the practice went fine. When we do the show tomorrow night, all you have to do tomorrow in the ball game is hit a home run to win the game and then come on my show. With Edward R. Murrow was the name will come to me in a minute. Anyway, sure enough, Campanella hits a home run in the bottom of the eighth with the score tied 2-2 and win the ball game and then went on Edward R. Murrow's show. But that game for me represented probably the best game I ever pitched because I had such motivation not to fail that third game that we needed so bad. And Campanella was a wonderful catcher because he didn't talk to you out loud, but all the way he gestured and the way he returned the ball, he actually controlled the speed of the game. And he wouldn't let a pitcher go too fast or he wouldn't let him go too slow. And I never was a real slow between pitches, but Campy kept you calmed down just by the way he handled the pitch, returning it to you and so forth. So that day, Campy just moved his glove and I had hit it. I didn't know how many strikeouts I had, but I think in the eighth inning when I tied the record, I'm sorry about that. It was in the ninth inning. I tied the record of 13, and they announced it at Ebbets Field. But I didn't hear it because the crowd was noisy anyway. But there was a lot of noise after that announcement. Then I got Johnny Mize for the 14th strikeout. One of my toughest outs was Johnny Mize. He was a tough hitter. But I got him on a good overhand curveball, and then the crowd went bananas. But I didn't hear the announcement that was a record. It was only after the game that one of my pitching buddies, Preacher Rowe, came over to my locker, pushed his way through the crowd of writers, and he said, "Carl, you know, you set a strikeout record." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, you got 14. Well, that's how I knew that I got the record. And then I happened to be in the stands on the same date, October 2nd, 1963, 10 years. I watched Koufax get 15 strikeouts and broke one. But he was a teammate. It wasn't like losing it so much that a teammate got it. So I was in the clubhouse. I went in the clubhouse and talked to Sandy after that game. And I've got a picture of me with Sandy. And he was a great pitcher then, but he became even greater the next few years.
Well, in 1955, the Dodgers delivered that World Series championship. You'd had such a great rivalry back and forth with the Yankees and a lot of close battles in those World Series, but the Yankees had won all of them in that stretch up to that time. But in 1955, you broke through and got the win in seven games. Tell me about what that meant to you and your teammates and also to the Brooklyn fan base.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that last comment because it was almost an embarrassment to these teams that I played on. The 52 teams and the 53 teams, the records that these guys put together was one of the greatest teams in baseball, and yet we did not win the World Series, and our fans continued to be disappointed, even though we put these great teams together. And if you looked at the numbers of the RBIs and all the rest, those two teams, 52 and 3, were some of the great teams of all time, but no World Series. So in 55, I remember being opening day pitcher in 55 against the Pirates. I beat the Pirates 5-1, and we got us off to a start. But we won, I think, 10 straight, and then we lost one, won another 10 or 12. So So, and that was in 55. So we went wire to wire in 55, and I don't think that ever happened to us, and won the World Series. But here's an oddity. A short series always produces some surprises because things can happen in 1 week in a regular season, and then you play more games and it kind of gets lost. But in the postseason, when you play the World Series, that short series, you have certain things happen that are unique. Maybe the superstars aren't the ones that always get the headlines. And in a sense, that's what happened in 55. Newcomb and I were starting pitchers. Newt, of course, won 27 games one year and 22 or 3 to another. I only had one 20-game season, but we were the core of the pitching staff. We didn't, either one of us, win a game in that 55 series. I started game 4 and got taken out for a pinch hitter, and we ended up winning it. Levine got the win. But here's my point. Johnny Padres was only in his second year, a little left-hand pitcher. He was 8-9 during the regular season, but he won game 2 or 3 and then ended up winning game 7. He won 2 games in this series, shut out the Yankees 2-0 in the final game, and brought that elusive World Series title to Brooklyn. And I think Duke Snyder, Hodges, Campy, Pee-wee, Perillo, Snyder, all those guys that made that finally happen, I think they were more happy for the fans of Brooklyn than it was for ourselves. Because finally, we delivered that magic ring to Brooklyn. And in a sense, it brought the dignity to the borough of Brooklyn that had always been elusive in baseball. And we're always kind of the orphan borough with the Yankees, the big Yankees, and the Giants, who'd had a great history. But now the Dodgers owned the World Series ring. And I think we felt more satisfaction for our fans than we even did for ourselves.
We mentioned earlier about, the Dodgers leaving Brooklyn after the 57 season. There was one more World Series in 1956, and you pitched a no-hitter during the regular season in 1956 as well. But the end of the 57 season brought the end of baseball in Brooklyn. And if you could just recount maybe the last days, the last weeks, and how people felt at that time.
Well, there's a couple ways that I've always felt about that or looked at it. You know, when you're in love, sometimes you can say some of the nastiest things to the people you love the most. And it was sort of that love affair in Brooklyn that this team had produced very few pennants up till Jackie era. And, you know, from 47 to 57, that decade, I think there were 6 championships there in one World Series. And that was the Jackie Robinson era. But the fans in Brooklyn, they were more than just flag-waving fans. They sort of lived it out. They lived their life. And decades have gone by was that way in Brooklyn, but they never had a lot to celebrate. And now, in this era of the Jackie Robinson era, that team became dominant in the National League. And yet we had trouble bringing home the big series to win it all. But now, before we left for Los Angeles, we did get the pennant for the Dodgers in Brooklyn. But the bitter pill was only 2 years later, 57, the team pulled out. I always related that to a love affair. We only had 7,000 in the stands the last game played at Ebbets Field. And the fans were saying, "God, you bumps, go ahead, who cares? We don't love you anymore, go on. No, they did love us, and it did hurt. And it broke their hearts to have the team pull out after finally being world champions. So it's like a young person dying too young. That team left when it was the boys of summer was kind of in the latter part of their career, but still, it was like a young teenager dying too young. That's the way it broke the hearts of the fans in Brooklyn. But it took 60 years for history to play out. Walter O'Malley wanted to keep the team in Brooklyn, and the spot he wanted to get was not made possible by the city administration. But 60 years later, where the Nets now play in the NBA is exactly where they built the big arena, is exactly where Walter O'Malley wanted to build the ballpark for the Brooklyn Dodgers. So if he'd have got his way, maybe the Dodgers would still be there. But it was a bitter pill for the fans to have the championship 1 year, and a couple years later, the team thumbs their nose and says goodbye.
Well, I have just a couple of more questions for you, if you don't mind. I was going to ask you about the moving to Los Angeles. You started the very first home game played by the Los Angeles Dodgers, and they were playing at the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum. And baseball fans, if they weren't following that era, it's hard to imagine baseball being played there. But it was, with some unusual dimensions. What do you recall about that first home game for the Los Angeles Dodgers?
Well, there was a lot of hype, of course, because the first game played in Los Angeles and in the Coliseum, which seated over 100,000, I think counting all the official count was 79,000, but all the comps that were there, it was over 80. And I was I didn't have a real good spring in 58, and yet I was kind of surprised Walt Alston picked me to pitch the opener in Los Angeles. But he did. And so it was kind of a wild game. I think we made three errors that day on that hard infield. Somebody said the circus had just pulled out before we played the first game in the Coliseum. But it was a big crowd, a quiet crowd, because Ebbets Field held 35,000, I think. And, man, it was a noisy place. And the field was close to the players. This big stadium swept back. Fans for the first game were all celebrity people. In fact, about the second inning, I looked over to the dugout, and the guys in the dugout were gawking over the back of the dugout to all the movie stars that were in the stands behind our dugout. And I thought, this is a new day in baseball for me playing in a football stadium. But it was kind of a ragged game, and we end up winning 6-5. I pitched into the eighth inning, and Levine relieved me and got to the save. I did get the first win in L.A. It was a 10th. I think I allowed about 10 hits in that game, so it wasn't a pitching jewel. But a win's a win.
You had, I believe, your last complete game as an active pitcher was in 1958, and that came after a visit to Roy Campanella, who was paralyzed after an automobile accident in January of that year. That had to be a difficult time for everyone associated with the Dodgers, but tell me about the circumstances leading up to that complete game victory.
Yeah, we were in Philadelphia, which is about a two-hour plane train ride from New York. We knew Campy had been injured, was in the hospital, but none of us had seen him in spring training or the early part of the season. So, but before the game that night in Philly, it rained, and they finally postponed the game, rainout game, and so we had the night free. I got on the train, rode back to New York, went to the hotel, unannounced, to see Roy. And the family was there, and they said, no visitors. When they heard it was a teammate, they said, oh, yeah, he comes up. So I went up, and the family left the room by that time. So I walked in the room, and here's Campy face down on a very special bed because he had a broken neck. And he was in this special bed, looking face down. And when I walked in, I think Campy saw the whole team. He couldn't say anything. I couldn't say anything. It was just a moment or two of really tough silence. And then finally, you know, we started exchanging thoughts to each other. And I was player representative for the Dodgers. And Campy, first thing he said to me, "Carl, you know what? I used all my insurance already because I had to have a tracheotomy and a broken neck." And he said, "The first thing you guys, player reps, ought to do is check out the insurance. It ought to be bigger." But anyway, Roy was a good spirit. And we chatted that night, and he said, "You know, I'm upside down here, but with the mirrors arranged just right, I can watch television. So I'll be watching the game tomorrow night in Philly. And good luck. I know you're pitching." Well, I couldn't get Roy off my mind. I went back that night on the train. So the next night I start warming up. And every pitch I threw, I'm thinking about Roy laying in that bed watching the game through the mirrors. And I must have got an extra little charge because I was toward the end of my career. And I had a no-hitter in that game up, into the seventh inning. And finally, Chuck Asigian singled, an infield single that broke it up. But I ended up winning 2-1, my last complete game in the majors. And I think, however you say it, somehow Campy helped me win my last game. I knew he was watching. I couldn't help but think about it on every pitch. So that was a good way for me to finish up.
And then you retired the following year, 1959. I know you dealt with arm trouble really your entire career, but you did. It was your decision. You made the decision to retire and step away rather than waiting for a trade or release or some other circumstance to happen to you. Tell me about that decision at that time.
Well, I'd always been a productive pitcher. I'd always been able to win more than my losses. I'd been mostly a starting pitcher in the minors and the big league. I relieved some in my early years, but I was a dependable starter every 4 days for 12 seasons. But I did have an arm injury early in my career, and I fought that until I had to finally retire at age 32. But the old timers would tell a young pitcher, a young player who was boasting about they'll never get this uniform off of me. They'll have to tear it off of me. And the old-timers would calmly say, "Now, son, when the time comes, you'll know it, and you'll take it off with pride." Exactly what happened to me. I felt myself unproductive. I was stressful about it. I talked to Alston, the manager, and I said, "Walt, you know, I just can't come up to the standard that I think I have to help the team, and so I'm going to retire." That's what I did. The Dodgers kept me on the rest of the season as a coach, and so I got to work out my last contract, and then I did retire. So I did know it. When the time came, I took it off and hung it up with dignity.
Well, we appreciate you spending this time with us, probably a little more time maybe than I'd originally promised to keep you. So I appreciate you telling these stories and sharing your memories of your experience in baseball. Carl Erskine has been our guest. The books are What I Learned from Jackie Robinson and Tales from the Dodger Dugout. Sir, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I wish you well, and thanks again for being on today.
Well, my pleasure. It's always an honor. Thanks for remembering an old-timer.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.